This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. You're listening to Detailing Addiction on America's Web Radio. Today we have several interesting topics, and the first one I want to start off with is a quick reminder that we are about to go to daylight saving time on March 9th. And unfortunately, this really causes a lot more problems psychologically and physically than you would have expected. And though it is making our exposure to daylight longer, which certainly can help with vitamin D and seasonal affective disorder, just changing the clock creates quite a problem. So I have David Donaldson from the Atlanta Healing Center with me today. And tell us a little bit about what happens when we go through the spring forward, which we're just about to do.
Hi, Susan. I'm very glad to be here. I absolutely love daylight savings. I look forward to this day coming. As soon as we change the clocks back in the fall, I go ahead and mark it on the calendar for the next year for when it's coming. Because for me, that missing hour of light is just sad. but there are a lot of things that happen with the spring change that don't tend to happen in the fall. Some of the things that they've noticed is that there's many more car accidents. What we recognize is that it takes really a full week to adjust to the change of the time. And so people are more sleep deprived, and they're more apt to have sleep deprived accidents, sleep deprived just the fumbles in their day.
Right. Workplace injuries certainly go up. A 2009 study in the Journal of Applied Psychology looked at what happens to workers the Monday after the switch in time, in the spring forward category I'm talking about. And they indicate that there's almost 6% more accidents, work-related accidents, that day than there and in the week following the switch to daylight saving time than there is at any other week of the year. So that's certainly much more difficult and dangerous.
They've also found that there's more heart attacks. Swedish researchers in a study in 2008 showed that the rate of heart attack during the first three weekdays following the daylight savings time change increases about 5%.
The New England Journal also did a study in 2008 trying to figure out why this might be. And when we have to spring forward and lose an hour or at least 40 minutes is the usual amount of time that most people lose in terms of sleep, they find that in order to wake up, we have a surge in a hormone called cortisol. Cortisol is normally supposed to be there starting about half hour before we wake up in order to increase our heart rate, our blood pressure, our body temperature so that we come out of sleep and are bright, wide awake. When you have to get up early and deal with this lack of sleep, they propose that it's actually these stress hormones coming into play causing increased amount of inflammation as well as just an increase in heart rate and blood pressure, and it already adds to the risk for someone who has coronary artery disease. And another important one is related to headaches. I didn't realize there were more headaches this time of year.
They've noticed there's cluster headaches. So the headaches that are quite similar to migraines in the sense that they're coming in clusters, increase throughout the body each day, affecting their mood, their energy level, their hunger level, their need for more sleep. Just by waking up 1 hour during daylight savings time earlier, it's causing the body to set up this situation. So in particular, people who already are dealing with chronic pain issues or migraine issues may find that they have an increase of this at this time. I was really kind of interested in the last one where it was talking about the heart attacks and looking at the changing hormone levels, what we find in dealing with addiction and dealing with the reality that we recognize that addicts' hormone levels are already way out of whack when they're first getting treatment, and they're already dealing with significant sleep issues, that during this adjustment to spring, real often that relapse rates will go up.
Yes.
There'll definitely be a increase in stress levels at this period of time. We always talk about it as kind of like spring fever, and people are planning their spring trips, and they're thinking about what they're going to do with their summers. And even though we know one day is just like the next and we're living one day at a time, the brain is conditioned already for making a party out of this time of year and gets geared towards that. And so this is definitely a time period where really working on keeping a regular sleep schedule and working on keeping a regular routine will help. I actually go ahead and start changing my clocks on Friday to adjust for that. I'll change my clocks at work on Friday before I leave, at home Friday night when I go to sleep. So I'll have all day Saturday and all day Sunday to adjust to this change. And I've done this for the past 5-10 years and really have noticed an amazing difference.
So that actually helps you and gives you an opportunity to adjust your circadian rhythm over the weekend.
Over the weekend prior to having to jump back into Monday in regular routine.
And that certainly, I guess you're aware of any kind of appointments or obligations that you have that weekend to adjust that time in your brain. But that sounds like a great idea for folks that can do that, mm-hmm. to give themselves a couple of days before they have to get up that Monday morning and try and drive to work where they have an increased risk of car accidents, get to work, have an increased risk of job-related accidents. I'm thinking of all of the folks up in the Northeast and actually around the country that are having to go out and shovel snow. We know that certainly many people have heart attacks just from that kind of physical labor. So if you add to that an issue with changing their circadian rhythm and losing an hour's sleep, doesn't seem like much, but studies have been pretty clear that it actually does have an impact on our health. George W. in 2005 signed a change in our energy policy where we now start daylight saving time the second Sunday in March. And it will officially end the first Sunday in November. That same year, interestingly enough, Kazakhstan abolished it because of some of the reasons that we listed above. They don't change. We have a number of states, Hawaii
and
Arizona.
Mm-hmm. That don't follow it at all.
Heroin.
We're
getting
subject,
to that.
Heroin. But right now, the daylight savings Arizona doesn't follow it, and Hawaii doesn't follow it.
Right.
It's interesting because it's actually with George Bush's change, it's happening about 2 weeks earlier than what we're used to.
Right.
And that 2 weeks, the difference between what it feels like outside now and in 2 weeks is really pretty drastic. So a lot of times it just feels like it's hitting wrong. It's hitting too early. I'm still very quite grateful about it, but
you just like spring. I understand
love spring.
That. We know that the first time the Americans actually adopted a daylight saving time program was during World War I as part of an energy conservation project in order to save more energy that would be able to allow a decrease in the country's need for artificial light by changing the daytime, nighttime. Benjamin Franklin was the one who initially suggested back in 1784 that we consider doing this because people burned so many more candles when we didn't have this change. And that we needed to get up earlier. And of course he was all about getting up early anyway. But, what we found is that there's really a cost in terms of springing forward and falling back. Did I get that right? I always get those two. I get them mixed up, fall back, spring, you know. Anyway, sorry. But there is a cost in terms of what happens to us physiologically. Many of us experience the same thing in terms of jet lag, and we know that for the rule of thumb is for every hour of time change that you go through with jet lag, it takes at least a day or more to have your body adjust. And this can create some real difficulties for our patients, too. Again, another warning around being careful. If folks can't sleep when they're supposed to sleep, not feeling tired that Monday night when they should be, or Sunday night when they should be going to sleep at 8 o'clock and they want to stay up because their body's on a different schedule, they need to be careful about that, because not sleeping is a big trigger both for psychiatric illnesses as well as for addiction. So,
yeah, I'm thinking in particular for patients that are also dealing with bipolar disorder.
Yes.
That they are a population particularly at risk for going into mania if their sleep cycle gets messed up. And many people in early recovery, especially the people who are recovering from amphetamine-type products, cocaine-type products, will have a similar experience in early recovery where if their sleep cycle that's been real hard to get normalized anyway gets messed up again, mm-hmm. then they're going to have more cravings, they're going to have more angst going on, and if they're dealing with bipolar, the likelihood that they're going to go into full-fledged mania at this time of year is definitely there.
Absolutely. And we know certainly, as you mentioned a few moments ago, the risk of relapse around spring break goes up pretty high. And we know a number of patients who that's really their risky time. That spring break is just bad news for many folks, particularly in early recovery. So we wish you all a happy spring forward, but please be careful. And you may want to consider the David Donaldson method of adopting to the change, which is do it a few days earlier so Monday isn't quite so hard. Today we're going to talk in general about two classes of substances that have really shown a considerable rise. And there was a new study coming out from the National Institute of Health looking at drug use, again, with our young people, teens and young adults. And the two things that are on the rise that many of us may not be aware of include heroin and hallucinogens. So today I thought we would talk a little bit about why are these substances so appealing, what are some of the effects, and what are the dangers of using these particular drugs. And heroin is first on our list. Certainly we're all aware of the many recent deaths from heroin overdose. And in talking with our patients, that adds to the intrigue when they hear that there's heroin in town that is causing people to die. They are much, much more interested in finding out where to get it, and they want to use it. This seems very counterintuitive to most of us, but that's exactly what's happening. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to talk about this tremendous appeal of heroin. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
This is David Donaldson with the Atlanta Healing Center, conveniently located in Lawrenceville, Georgia. At AHC, your success is our goal. Addiction recovery is about more than just not using. It's about becoming a whole person and addressing all aspects of your physical, psychological, and social needs. Please call us at 770-696-9862, or you can reach us on the web at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Hi, I'm Paisley McDonald, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my show, At Home with Paisley, every week, Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern, for practical advice and stylish living for your home and office.
Hello, this is Michael Daly with Atlanta Healing Center. We know that addiction is a brain disease. Addiction is a family disease. Addiction is a treatable disease. We have a caring professional staff with over 30 years experience to help you and your loved ones in your recovery. You can reach us at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. This is Detailing Addiction, and in studio today I have David Donaldson, who is the CEO and head of the clinical program at the Atlanta Healing Center. We're talking about the increased use and the surge of interest in not only heroin but hallucinogens. The monitoring, the future studies by the NIH have just been released in the last week or so. Good news is that the use of tobacco is down. The use of alcohol is down. What is going up, unfortunately, is the use of illicit drugs, including heroin and hallucinogens. So I thought we'd look at these a little bit more in detail and understand why would it be that if heroin, the particular type of heroin that has been killing people in Pennsylvania and Rhode Island and in New York, when people die, why would that be an appeal to young people around the country to go out and try and find that very same heroin? It's astonishing to me, but I have heard this from a number of patients that this creates a great appeal, that if it's so good and gets you so close to dying, gotta have it.
Well, and that is exactly the quote that so many of our patients will say, that when they hear that something is that good out there, they don't hear something is that deadly, something is that poisonous, something is being tainted in such a bad way as it's killing people. What their brain hears is this is really, really, really good stuff. Mm-hmm. And their brain also says, I'll be fine. Part of the denial system that they have going on is I've been using it for a while. I can handle it. I've got the tolerance built up that I'll be able to get really, really high again and I'll be fine. And I actually think that's part of the piece of the addiction too, is that for so many heroin addicts, they haven't gotten high in a long time.
Yes.
They're using to maintain, they're using to avoid pain, they're using to function. But that real high that they originally got hooked on and that they loved, they haven't really experienced. And so when they hear that this is out there, their brain, the dings in their brain are like, ding, 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 here we go. Mm-hmm. We can have a little bit of a party again. And they don't believe they're going to die.
Right. And that is the real, real scary piece of this, because unfortunately, we know that people who have been in recovery, who have gone through a detox, and who have a little bit of distance from their last use are much more likely to die if they go back out, if they relapse. So that first year, first 2 years in recovery is so dangerous because their tolerance has shifted back down a little bit in terms of lethality. And they don't really recognize that. They're really going for the high. If they decide they're going to relapse, they're going to go out and do it right. So, and I'm saying that in quotes, folks. I don't mean do it right. But they're really looking to really get high, and they often really get dead.
Mm-hmm.
And part
of the dynamics that are going on right now is that heroin is really hitting a younger generation. And the 2012 NSDUH, National Survey of Drug Use and Health in America, the 2007 really talks about how it's hitting at a younger age.
Right.
And this is an age that doesn't believe they're going to die anyway.
Right, the 18 to 25-year-olds.
18 to 25s, that portion of the brain that says, you know, I'm infallible and I can have problems and I might not live through this, isn't fully connected. You know, we talk with our patients about the maturation process of the brain, and that portion of the brain thinks they're invincible anyway. And so then they have a drug that's telling them, you are going to feel so amazingly good, and their brain is saying, I'm going to be fine, it becomes a real quick lethal combination.
Frightening. Since 2007, when prescription drug abuse really began to be in the forefront, it was in the news, it was in the press, certainly as a physician, we began to see more and more education for both primary care doctors as well as pain management doctors about proper use of prescription opiates for pain. Some of the opiate companies actually began to add components to their medication or change the delivery system so that crushing or injecting was now going to be problematic for folks abusing the substances. As we've seen a decrease in prescription drug use, we're seeing a significant increase in the amount of heroin use, both because it's much cheaper, but also because it's sometimes more available to the young drug users. It's pretty hard as an 18 or 19-year-old to go in and get a long-term prescription for a chronic pain medication at a high dose. So they have to use other methods to get their source of medicine, and sometimes it's borrowing it from family members with or without their knowledge. Sometimes it's trading with friends. But eventually, if they have to buy these prescription pain medications over on the street, at a dollar a milligram, it becomes very expensive. Mm-hmm. Heroin is much cheaper, and it's much more readily available. And I think since 2007, that's part of the explanation of the rise in heroin use in our young people. We see it certainly east of the Mississippi. Is the part of the country that has been much more affected by heroin. Most of it is coming in either from South America or from Southeast Asia. Certainly we're seeing the black tar heroin, which is another form of it, less pure, that's coming in from Mexico. And we understand that, of course, heroin is made from the seed pod of the poppy plants. Afghanistan has been a big source of heroin production for many years, and it's certainly...
For the entire world.
Yes, and it's certainly something that we are greatly concerned about, both for public health and safety, but also from a political standpoint. Often lots of questions as to why we have not just spread a pesticide across the poppy fields of Afghanistan, but that's a whole nother story for another day. Today we're talking about the appeal of heroin and why people have been using it. The biggest group is the 18 to 25-year-olds, but we are seeing younger people, mm-hmm. and we are seeing older people who come in using heroin for the first time.
For the first time. And we're actually seeing people who are using heroin as their first exposure to opiates, which is really kind of a surprise to me, because for the longest time it was that transition that you were talking about earlier, where they would start taking pills from the medicine cabinet or from their friend or something, and then they would get hooked and they'd have to keep feeding the addiction, and they would go and they'd get somebody and suddenly just kind of do this transition. Oops, I don't have any of those pills today, but here I have some heroin, and look, it's so much cheaper. But we're actually meeting people now who are pot smokers, and they've been smoking pot for a long time, and drinking and smoking pot, and they go to buy their pot, and the guy says, oh, here, look, this would be cool, and they're transitioning directly from pot to heroin without any other exposure to opiates. So that, for me, is part of the scariness of how this is spreading out. It used to be such what we would talk about as an inner city or an urban drug, and we just never really saw it out in the suburbs. And the reality now is we're seeing it a lot out in the suburbs.
Right, and it's across the social strata. We're seeing young people, old people, poor people, wealthy people. We're seeing.
And young people used to tell us they'd have to really plan it out because they'd have to get in their car and they'd have to deal with Atlanta traffic to go down and score. But they're not having to say that anymore. Now they're able to just kind of go around the block and they're able to get it in their hometowns. So it is definitely changing in terms of the geographical spread of heroin in our state.
And I think that the entrance of the Mexican drug cartels into the distribution of drugs in the United States has changed things dramatically as well, because Mexico has become a very strong source of methamphetamine as well as heroin as well as pot. So a couple of shows ago, David, you talked about the idea that it's one-stop shopping. You've got a drug dealer who now deals in multiple substances, whether it's MDMA, whether it's salvia, whether it's heroin, whether it's pot. They can go.
If you want to go up, if you want to go down.
They can manage it, and that is one of the ways that we're seeing a lot of people becoming exposed to heroin that normally would not be getting in their cars and driving down to the bluff to get heroin. They can now get it at their corner, mm-hmm. just as you said, and one-stop shopping. The other thing that we talk about alcohol and nicotine and marijuana being gateway drugs, drugs that most of our patients, that's their first drug of exposure, their first drug of use. From a physiological standpoint, when we look at the brain, we know that there are actually four substances that, whether you like uppers, whether you like downers, these four different chemicals will be whatever you want to be. And for the first time, we're seeing people who like uppers, who like cocaine, who like methamphetamine, Ritalin, ecstasy, they also like heroin. And you wouldn't think that, because heroin has been for a long time thought of as the downer drug. So if you liked alcohol or benzos or other pain medicines, you would like heroin. But physiologically, heroin, alcohol, marijuana, and nicotine each work separately, together, individually. It doesn't matter. They work on both the uppers, the part of the brain that likes uppers, the part of the brain that likes downers. Heroin can be whatever you want it to be as well. And the possibility for cross-addiction, for people moving from cocaine, moving from methamphetamine, and also enjoying heroin is one of the common things we're seeing. And we're seeing this with older addicts as well, people that normally only liked uppers, also now being introduced by their one-stop shopping drug dealers to heroin as an alternative. It's really quite interesting to me that is the process. We're going to take a break right now. We'll talk a little bit more when we come back about heroin and also hallucinogens. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Michael Daly with Atlanta Healing Center. We know that addiction is a brain disease. Addiction is a family disease. Addiction is a treatable disease. We have a caring professional staff with over 30 years experience to help you and your loved ones in your recovery. You can reach us at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Hi, I'm Paisley McDonald, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my show, At Home with Paisley, every week, Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern, for practical advice and stylish living for your home and office.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options, such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle, medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. You're listening to Detailing Addiction on America's Web Radio. Today we're talking about two classes of drugs that have been on the rise, and the recent Monitoring the Future studies show that heroin is significantly increasing across all ages, but in particular the 18 to 25-year-olds. Very, very scary. We know that 150,000 people in the United States have started using heroin in 2012. That's double the amount that we saw in 2006. Past year heroin use among the nation's 8th, 10th, and 12th graders has increased in all three grades. From 2005 to 2013, although it's still less than 1%, that is still significant in terms of what we are seeing and what we are afraid of. It's really, really very, very difficult to get a whole idea about it, but we're seeing more and more young adults coming in for treatment for heroin use. In fact, it's increased from 11% in 2008 to 26% just in the first half of 2012. 26% of the 18 to 25-year-olds seeking treatment for addiction are coming in because of heroin, not because of opiates.
Alcohol or cocaine or any of the other.
It's because of heroin, and that's really, really scary to me.
Now, this is interesting to me. In a similar study, or in three other studies, they have found that half of the people seeking treatment for heroin, so 50% of the people seeking treatment for heroin, described abusing opiates and other forms before ever trying heroin, so that definitely fits what we were experiencing at AHC, Atlanta Healing Center, for a long time, that it had been that path going from taking and abusing prescription, not necessarily their prescription, but somebody's prescription opiates prior to ever trying heroin. I believe that, those numbers are going to be changing in the next couple of years. There are, I don't know if you've seen some of the PSAs out there now about parents being aware of where your medication are going. They have the one where the teenager is getting into the medicine cabinet and taking his mother's pills, and the mom thinks that she's the one that's using those pills when in fact it's not. As a society, we're beginning to crack down on opiate use.
Right.
But the addiction to opiates is already there, and so they're moving on into heroin. But there's also, as I was saying earlier, we're seeing more people who are going directly to heroin.
Many, many more young people are doing this, and one of the difficulties is that heroin is such a potent, powerful drug. The increased use of heroin, what you need to get high, what you need to just feel normal, then what you need to keep from being sick, escalates very rapidly. And though all opiates can cause some significant changes to the brain, heroin causes significant imbalances in our brain chemistry, creating a long-term problem that is very difficult for our patients to come back from, and it's not easily reversed. It affects not just their sleep-wake cycle. It affects their hormonal cycle. It affects their mood. It causes such a disruption to their brain chemistry that coming off of it, while the taper is difficult and the withdrawal can be very, very unpleasant, it's that long-term anhedonia, lack of interest in things, lack of motivation. Everything looks like it's painted gray. And our patients have a really, really hard time finding any kind of joy or pleasure in life when they've been using heroin. It's really, really scary. And then when you add to that the idea that they can overdose and die at any given time, they have no idea what it's been cut with. They have no idea the toxicity. They have no idea the dose. And it's a Russian roulette, which unfortunately I think adds to the appeal that I can die from this every time I use. We don't get that with many other drugs.
No.
You can drink too much and you can have alcohol poisoning and you can die. That's very rare, fortunately.
A couple weeks ago you had talked, when we were just talking about other drugs of abuse and of addiction and everything, you had talked about 6 a.m. As an aspect that makes heroin different from opiates.
Right.
And I wonder if you could reiterate that piece, just because I think that the addictive nature of heroin, I mean, opiates are addictive in the
right.
high quantities and the rapidness of which they were taking it is something. But that piece of it really, I think, makes heroin a unique product that we need to be reminded of.
The original structure of heroin, it is taken from the poppy plant. That compound, 6-AM, is the really high that you get. It's the substance that doesn't stay around very long. And, in fact, it's really... Well, I was going to say it's unusual that we see that in a drug screen confirming heroin, but more and more we are seeing it in our drug screens. That aside, that releases massive amounts of dopamine in a very quick way and then gets off the receptor sites. Heroin breaks down to morphine and morphine alone, so that's at the more longer lasting. But this idea of the chemical structure of 6-AM, the 6-monoacetylmorphine, that is the hook that gets people so high so quickly, and there's nothing like it.
And so if you see that on a drug screen,
yes.
if they actually test positive at a countable number for 6-AM, that tells us that they have used opiates, they've used heroin specifically, within 6 hours?
Probably less than that, within 2 to 4 hours
of taking that drug screen. So listen to the insanity for me in working with patients that are heroin addicts, that they will come and they will sit there and they'll talk to you and they'll have their eyes will be fighting to stay open and they'll have the nods going on. And they will have done heroin within 2 to 4 hours of being in the room, and they will sit there and say, I haven't been using drugs. I don't know what you're talking about. They'll say this to the entire group.
Right.
I haven't been using drugs. And there'll be clean heroin addicts in the rooms sitting there looking at them saying, I know exactly what you've done. I've done that. I know that look to a T. And the denial system is still sitting there saying, I don't have a clue what you're talking about.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just using real simple heroin. One of the things that I think is really important, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, has created an opiate overdose program that a toolkit is now available to first responders, police officers, paramedics, doctors, and the goal is to actually begin to provide these kits to individuals who have been taking prescription drugs just in case they were to have an overdose, but also make them available in an amnesty type of way where if someone is overdosing, that immediately this medication called Narcan is available by injection. They're trying to develop some alternative ways of using this medication, whether it's in a sublingual, an aerosol, a transdermal, or an auto-injector that can protect people from overdose, because we are seeing so many people who are dying of this. So
the thing that's interesting with that, It's a very, very low dose.
Right.
Naltrexone. So if somebody is in a major overdose and going out and you give them this low dose, it's not going to save their life.
Right.
It's going to stop the overdose temporarily, but you'd still need to dial 911 and you still need to get them to a hospital really quickly, because unless you have several of these low dose doses to use as this person is coming through the withdrawal, they're going to go back into the withdrawal symptoms really fairly quickly. So it's a great thing that they're coming out with something to help people that are going into withdrawal, or I mean going into overdose. A big part of why people die is because people are afraid to call 911.
Right.
They're afraid they're going to get arrested. They're afraid they're going to end up in all kinds of major consequences. And that being said, that once they start trying to save this person, they need to keep going and call 911 and get help to the situation.
Absolutely. It buys you a little time, but not a lot of time. This person still is in a medical emergency. This person still needs to have medical attention. It just keeps them from dying this very second. But you still have to call the 911. You still have to get them to a safe place. There are a number of medications that are available to treat people who have heroin addiction. I think it's really important that we not just talk about how horrible this all is, but we also talk about the idea that we have a number of categories of medications that can be helpful in getting folks not only through the withdrawal, but also through a period of time to assist them with their sobriety. We have full agonists like methadone that's been around for a long time that is prescribed by physicians in clinics that are federally overseen. That medication it has been available and has helped people on a regular basis. There's some downsides. People can use on that medicine. People can, and they have to go to the dispensing site every day for a long period of time in order to get their medication. But it does allow them a safe way to not use heroin and to get their life back on track. Buprenorphine, it has been available in both the product with and without naltrexone. A lot of work has gone into trying to get people to not use the buprenorphine alone product, and there's a recent study that has shown that it doesn't hurt anybody, including pregnant women, to use the combination drug. The combination is there as a protective against in using the Suboxone or the buprenorphine by injecting it. For a lot of times, people would say, oh, well, we shouldn't use this in young people. We shouldn't use this in pregnant women. Studies are now showing that it is not a problem if you use the drug appropriately, mm-hmm. As it's supposed to be under your tongue. And then there's a complete agonist, which is the naltrexone, a long-acting form of Narcan, or Vivitrol, which is an injection. So all of these things are there to help deal with some of the physiological problems associated with heroin use and withdrawal. None of these are okay by themselves. They're not a solution. You really do need to have the behavioral therapies and psychotherapy to help people learn to cope. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about hallucinogens and dissociative drugs, and then a little bit about medical marijuana here in the state of Georgia. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. Please stay tuned.
This is David Donaldson with the Atlanta Healing Center, conveniently located in Lawrenceville, Georgia. At AHC, your success is our goal. Addiction recovery is about more than just not using. It's about becoming a whole person and addressing all aspects of your physical, psychological, and social needs. Please call us at 770-696-9862, or you can reach us on the web at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Hi, this is Kate Copsey, inviting you to listen year-round to America's Homegrown Veggie Show every Saturday at 10 a.m.
Hello, this is Michael Daly with Atlanta Healing Center. We know that addiction is a brain disease. Addiction is a family disease. Addiction is a treatable disease. We have a caring professional staff with over 30 years experience to help you and your loved ones in your recovery. You can reach us at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. You're listening to Detailing Addiction on America's Web Radio. I have with me David Donaldson from the Atlanta Healing Center, and we're talking about heroin and hallucinogens and dissociative drugs. This hallucinogen group is the next group that we're seeing a tremendous increase in use among our young people. What's very interesting to me is that a particular hallucinogen called Salvia divinorum is a hallucinogen plant that comes from one of my favorite places to vacation, unfortunately, Mexico. And this is a hallucinogenic substance that we're seeing a lot more use. In fact, that's the one that's really escalating among young people, although I have to tell you so many of our folks are using LSD again. We thought that that was a thing of the 60s and 70s. Well, I have to tell you, it's never completely gone away, but we're seeing more and more young people who are using LSD on a fairly regular basis. Astonishing, isn't it?
It's amazing. With the young people that we are talking to that are using it, It's discussed like it is just such a part of their culture and such a part of their world that this is just a normal thing that everybody does it. It's amazing to me how it's one drug that you will just completely won't hear about it at all. You won't meet somebody who's used it or even seen it for 2-3 years. And then the next thing you know, it's everywhere again. And that's kind of what's happening at this point. We're noticing it again. With quite a few clients in our intake interview.
Really very, very interesting, because we have the classic hallucinogens, which are LSD and psilocybin, which is a magic mushroom, as known around our young people. Again, this is from South America and Mexico and southern United States. This is a very common hallucinogen that we see.
I was going to say in Georgia.
In Georgia.
It is one that you do hear of, commonly grown in Georgia and talked about as shrooms. And the people who love shrooms absolutely love shrooms, mm-hmm. the whole experience of it. And they'll sit there and they'll be having what appears to be a hallucinogenic experience as you're talking to them about it.
And they really, really like it. We have another class of drugs called dissociative drugs, PCP and ketamine. Both of these substances were originally developed as anesthetics. They were still around, and we see a big source of these coming from veterinary clinics now. We don't use either of these too much for human medicine, although there is now a rise in looking at ketamine for treating certain types of complex regional pain, and also as a, believe it or not, treatment for depression. Everything old is new again. Remember when they used to try and use LSD as a treatment for depression, anxiety? Well, there are some studies, and actually the studies look pretty good in terms of results using ketamine for treatment of depression, but it's a dissociative that is used primarily as an anesthetic. Young people really like it. If they can't get it, their next choice is generally dextromethorphan, which was developed as an alternative to codeine and morphine as a cough syrup. But when used in large, large doses, it has this dissociative effect that we are very well aware of. And then we see the salvia that is this plant coming from South America that causes a lot of problems with hallucinations and distortions in reality. These substances are sort of a mystery to me, but people who love these really, really love them, and they love the way they make them feel and the moving out of reality and the distortion in time and place. And they have a lot of fun not only taking them but also with the rituals around using them. Another one that's sort of talked about in this same area is GHB, GABA hydroxybutyrate. It is a form of a benzodiazepine, but it does give a dissociative, distorted time, space, and changes the way people perceive things, hear things.
Real often they'll describe it as kind of a happy love. They can look at the mirror and just mm-hmm. really kind of like what they see and feel really happy in the moment. It'll have the benzo impact of kind of taking away the anxiety, but it has that little something extra that just, I'm assuming the GABA aspect of mm-hmm. it just puts a little bit of love in the whole equation.
A little bit of love is exactly what we find, and unfortunately, we do see some very vulnerable individuals, such as people with schizophrenia and other mental illness, really becoming much more symptomatic with the so-called positive symptoms of schizophrenia, seeing things that aren't there, hearing things that aren't there, and having distortions in reality and paranoia. These substances can really make those illnesses worse and can make it very difficult to treat these individuals with classic treatment.
What I tend to really experience with these substances in particular is that many of our patients will see these substances as no big deal.
Right.
These were just the kind of thing that I did on the side. My real drug of choice was alcohol, or my real drug of choice was blah, blah, blah. So these substances will become the one that they hang on to and can become the real big relapse factor. That they'll minimize the use of Special K, or they'll minimize the use of heroin, LSD. But as we were saying earlier, it's the one-stop shop, and so they'll still hang on to these substances, and it'll be the gateway back to the primary addiction.
I'd now like to switch gears in the last few minutes to talk about something that I think is really serious, and I would certainly urge any Native Georgians who have the ability to vote to contact their local senators to address the issue of medical marijuana. There's been a lot of distortion in the media, and certainly I think even among information given to our members of the House of Representatives. On Monday evening, they did pass the medical marijuana bill by a huge majority, 171-4, which is astonishing to me, having been down to the Capitol and been part of the process. The topic is, of course, related to intractable seizures that young babies are suffering from. There is a component called CBD, which is a non-hallucinogenic part of marijuana that seems to assist some people with stopping seizures. This substance is available as a pharmaceutical that has been purified, that has been tested for 5 years in London by GW Pharmaceuticals. There are doctors here in Georgia who have applied under the investigational drug protocol through the FDA and the DEA. They are allowed to use this substance to treat these young people and have them part of research studies to gather information about safety, efficacy, and dosing, as opposed to the substance that's grown by the Stanley brothers, six brothers who live in Colorado, who have developed a form and grown some cannabis that nobody really wanted because it didn't get them as high. They've created an oil that they want to give to these children. Parents are given this oil and told to give as much as it takes to have the baby stop having seizures. It is not overseen by doctors. It is not appropriately studied. It is not purified, and it is a great problem. The stance by the Georgia Society of Addiction Medicine, as well as ASAM, is, first of all, that we've reiterated several times that marijuana needs to go through the same standards that are applied to any other prescription drugs, and that these products should not be distributed or otherwise provided to patients unless and until such products or devices have received marketing approval from the FDA. We reject the idea of smoking as an appropriate drug delivery, and we also reject the process whereby state and local ballot initiatives can approve medications because these individuals are not qualified to make such decisions, and they do not have the ability to override our already approved process for not only approving and developing appropriate medications, but also providing dispensing. Our pharmacists are well trained and overseen by state and federal regulations. Georgia has a choice. It can listen to medical marijuana advocates or to the scientists. And as scientists, we strongly recommend Georgia does not go down the path of creating a state-based system for administering medical marijuana, and that parents with children who need them should enroll in these IND programs that are available to them. Please contact your senators and ask them to vote no on this particular drug process. We'll see you next week on Detailing Addiction.